I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every generation has its music. For many of us who were young in the 60s and 70s, that means the songs recorded during the Vietnam War and the ascendance of the electric guitar. Today, we revisit two conversations from 2016. First, a journalist and Vietnam vet who curated a list of the most influential songs that soldiers say helped them get through the war. Then, the international symbol of freedom, danger, and rebellion, the electric guitar. Hear riffs that rock the world and learn the stories behind them. To round things out, we finish with this week's State House Blend as we get you up to date after this hour's news.
When the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due. I know. Watch my dad.
You're listening to the unofficial anthem of soldiers back in the 1960s when they were more than a little eager to get out of a place called Vietnam. The life-saving impact of music may never have been more important than it was to the troops fighting in such a malign place as Vietnam. Doug Bradley and Craig Werner chronicle the importance of music and a host of key songs in their book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. That's the song we just listened to from The Animals. We're joined now by Doug Bradley, who's a Vietnam veteran from Madison, Wisconsin. He's worked on behalf of veteran issues since his discharge. He and his co-author, Craig Werner, teach a course at the University of Wisconsin entitled The Vietnam Era, Music, Media, and Mayhem. And Doug, so good to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here, and I'd like to extend a welcome home to all the vets that are listening today.
Oh, great. As you listen to that song, can you still see yourself in Vietnam?
Are you kidding? It's almost like I never left. That was 45 years ago today that I got out of Vietnam.
45 years ago today. Wow.
45 years ago today. And it's just, there was something about how that could pull people together. And that last line we sang, we changed it to There's a Better Life in the USA, because that's where we wanted to get back to.
Hey, why that song? Was it just that line, we got to get out of this place?
You know, it's really kind of interesting. Of course, it's literal, because in Vietnam, during our tours of duty, you had 13 months if you were a Marine, 12 months if you were Army. So you knew the day you were going to leave. And so that notion of getting out of that place, sure, there was a literal association. But boy, there's something about that song, about the beat, about the lyrics, about, it's a working class kind of song that really seemed to captivate and capture who we were and where we were and what in the heck we were dealing with.
You know, I can't help but wonder if Eric Burdon and the Animals realized the impact that song had on so many of you back in those days.
You know, it's a funny thing. I doubt if they did, and neither did Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, who wrote the song and intended it to be for the Righteous Brothers as a follow-up to You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. I'm convinced it would have been a hit. We've heard a demo of the song. Absolutely, absolutely great, but different. And so then it ends up overseas, and it became, for the Animals, sort of their kind of song. They were going from a rough working class kind of hard scrabble life in Newcastle, moving into London. So they were moving up and getting out of that place. And I don't think the writers or the Animals knew the power this was going to have in Vietnam. We have a wonderful story. Craig interviewed Eric Burden.
Yes, later,
and you know, Eric Burden talks about some Green Berets coming up to him, and he thought they were going to get all over his, you know, his case, and they thanked him for the song because it kept them alive in Vietnam.
That's amazing. Why a book on music in Vietnam, Doug?
Boy, why not? I mean, it's amazing when you think that it took us 10 years to write it, and there hasn't been one. Because I think, Steve, the whole notion of when you look back to that era, radio was our internet, and it connected all of us. We all listened to the same music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so as a generation, we were connected, identified, and joined by that music. And so when we were in Vietnam, especially guys like me are in the rear later in the war, when we know we're leaving, you know, we're turning over the ground war to the South Vietnamese and we're eventually going to go home. They, in order to keep our morale up, they gave us Creature Comforts, and what they gave us was music. Armed Forces Radio, you know, all throughout the country, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, cassette decks, reel-to-reel tape decks,
yes.
Bands in clubs, USO shows, touring acts like James Brown and Johnny Cash. So the music was just so universal and so important to us as a generation that the book almost like wrote itself.
Yeah.
And to add to that, Steve, the point here is I think that a lot of Vietnam veterans, because of that shameful legacy of the war, that they weren't welcomed home, they weren't encouraged to listen, they weren't healed, could not talk about that experience for 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
They could talk about a song. And in talking about the song, we think that a lot of the men and women we interviewed got back home.
And you found in the course of writing this book, I read, that when you interviewed these soldiers, I think you said if you began a conversation by saying, hey, tell me about your experience in Vietnam, you didn't get very far. But if you began the conversation by saying, hey, what music were you listening to when you were over in Nam? It was an entirely different experience.
Absolutely. And that wasn't the case with everybody we talked to. There's still some people that can't go there, even via music. But for a number of the folks, the fact that it helped that I was a vet, but I think even later, because, you know, Craig is very connected to the veteran community here and in Colorado where he grew up. I do think that made a difference. And the fact that we were willing to listen, these weren't sort of 3-minute conversations or 5-minute conversations. They sometimes took hours. And sometimes the men and women we talked to would bring their children or their spouses into the room because they hadn't heard some of this story either.
Wow. I just want to emphasize the point here that songs that so many of us here stateside never thought twice of were intensely personal to the soldiers in Vietnam. That's one of the key points of this book. Even taking a song like The Monkees' Last Train to Clarksville, which probably doesn't strike anybody as having any significance to a Vietnam war vet, but this line from that song clearly did, I don't know if I'm ever coming home, which sort of ends one of the stanzas there. It was a big hit over there.
Absolutely. And there is not too far from Clarksville, the real Clarksville, an Army base. And guys that were taking that last train to Clarksville to go there for advanced training, next stop was Vietnam. That had all the power in the world. And there's, you know, and I don't know if it's an urban legend because who can trust anything on the internet anymore sometimes. But the songwriters, Boyce and Hart, have said that was a Vietnam song for them.
Huh.
Now, we never got that when the Monkees did it, but trust me, guys who were in training and guys and women who were in Vietnam knew that was a Vietnam song.
How did you get the idea for the book?
It was really kind of interesting. Craig teaches these fabulous courses at the University on Music. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Nominating Committee, and he's the chair of Afro-American Studies, so he's deeply rooted in connections that and implications that music has, especially for African-Americans. He taught both of my kids. My kids grew up here and went to the university, and they kept telling me I had to meet this guy. And Christmas of 2004, we met at a vet center here for a Christmas party. He'd been invited because he'd had some Vietnam vets in his class to talk about music in Vietnam. And I was there because I'm a Vietnam vet. And we started this conversation. I thanked him for being a great teacher for my kids. And he asked me what I thought of the soundtrack for his course. He'd give me a copy of the CD that dealt with Vietnam. And I started saying, well, you got to realize that when I was there, it was this music and it was this situation. Next thing we knew, there were 6 or 7 other Vietnam vets standing around us saying, well, what about this? And what about that song? And, you know, have you thought of this? And he and I, even though we just met, we exchanged this glance like, wow, there's something going on here, and it's powerful. We met a couple months later and said, you know what, we got to write a book.
Doug Bradley is my guest. His book is We Gotta Get Out of This Place. It chronicles the music of the Vietnam War era. You know, when our producers first mentioned the possibility of having you on the show, the first song that came into my mind was Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth. In fact, that just was the first thing I thought would automatically be in the book. But you point out something else that far more common were songs that were more personal for lonely soldiers over there. Let's do this. Let's listen first to Buffalo Springfield For What It's Worth, and let's talk about the personal nature of some of these songs.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I still love that song. But your point
it's
is
a great song.
That wasn't the song of the Vietnam era, at least for the soldiers over there. Why not?
Well, you know, it was and it wasn't. It's great, Steve, that you segue to the song by talking about the personal nature. When we teach our class at Vietnam that you mentioned in the lead-in, we have vets come in and talk to the students. And we always ask the vets to start and end their presentation with a song that was important to them in Vietnam. And one semester, we had a woman who was a WAC in Vietnam and now is a Dominican nun. Her name is Sister Sarge, Linda McClanahan. And Bill Earhart, who was a Marine that was there during the Tet Offensive, had some of the most brutal experiences you can imagine in Vietnam. And they came in weeks apart, and Linda's song was For What It's Worth, and Bill's song was For What It's Worth. Huh. But for totally different reasons. Linda grew up in Berkeley and talked about seeing a police car burning at a demonstration. And at that point, she decided she didn't want the government or the protesters telling her what Vietnam was about. She wanted to go and see for herself. Mm. And she had to get her parents at the age of 18, she was under 21 as a woman, to sign the papers to let her go to Vietnam. Bill Earhart comes in a few weeks later and he says, For What It's Worth. We go, gee, that's kind of interesting. That was Linda's song. And he says he was back on leave between his tours in Vietnam, and he heard that song on the radio, and he said, I'm the man with the gun over there.
Oh, wow.
Same song,
wow.
You know, two different takeaways and different meanings. And that was the power of the music in Vietnam. You could make it your own. And as you said, oftentimes the sort of fallback position for folks was, I'm lonesome, I'm scared, I'm away from home, I miss the people I love the most.
Yeah.
And so a song like Dock at the Bay or Leaving on a Jet Plane or My Girl. But,
yeah.
You know, for as much as we put a sort of, we had a fun with the top 20 we put in the book, there are like 200 or 2,000 songs that meant something to the men and women who were there and came back home.
Yeah. Well, again, one of those songs, these personal songs that you just mentioned, you know, soldiers are missing their friends, their family, they're missing their girlfriends. One of those big songs was from Peter, Paul, and Mary. You just mentioned it. It's Leaving on a Jet Plane.
All my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting, he's blowing his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could cry. So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
You know, I'm guessing, Doug, that a lot of Vietnam vets listen to that song and get choked up pretty quickly.
Oh, boy. And, you know, some people who still can't listen to it. You know, the other interesting thing, Steve, for us was we made a presentation a few years ago at a Welcome Home celebration for Vietnam vets at Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin put together. we noticed that the wives were holding their husbands' hands and tears were streaming down their faces. And that was the first time I realized, you know, because I was the guy that got on the plane and said goodbye and went to Vietnam, that the women that stayed home and every day had to worry about us and didn't want to watch the news and didn't want to hear a knock on the door, what a year that was for them. And I think it really became manifest for me when I looked out at that audience and saw these women crying, realizing that that song was their song too.
Do you have a personal connection to that song?
I do. I do because, you know, I like Peter, Paul, and Mary. I was a John Denver fan. I thought that was one of the best songs that he ever wrote. And I was in love with a young woman. It's a relationship that didn't make it through Vietnam. But, you know, when I was saying goodbye to her, that song was playing in my head.
How many veterans did you wind up talking to for the book?
About 300.
Wow.
Like I said, some still couldn't get there or get back, but it was pretty astounding, and we felt privileged to be in those conversations with these folks that hadn't taken place for maybe 40 or 50 years, and to have maybe used that conversation and the music as a way to finally bring them back.
What else do you hear from the audiences that you speak to about your book and about the importance of music over there, Doug? What other stories have they told you?
It's really astounding that at almost every event, I was just at the Truman Presidential Library over the weekend, gave their Veterans Day speech and talked about this, and heard another story that a fellow has never talked. He was there with his sister, and he shared it with me after the presentation. And so what happens is that it becomes a safe place. There's something about the music that makes it safe for, I think, vets to begin to talk about things they haven't talked about in a long time. And that's the kind of stuff we hear. It's it is extraordinary to me to realize that it's taken this long. And again, it's one of those sad legacies about the war.
You know, we interesting email here. Paul called and said he would listen to a Country Joe and the Fish song, "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die," that had this chorus, and it's 1, 2, 3, "What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam." And it's 5, 6, 7, "Open up the pearly gates, ain't no time to wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die." There's a happy song for you.
You know, it's absolutely amazing, though, because Country Joe has been misunderstood. You know, since Woodstock, since he did that song. When we met Joe, we interviewed him for the book at the Bart Center in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The first thing he said to us was, "I'm a veteran first and a hippie second." Who knew Joe McDonald had been in the service?
I didn't know that, yeah.
Ah, and we didn't either. And Joe started talking about how that song was intended as gallows humor. And you can't get more gallows humor than lines like that, or be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box. Joe said he knew soldiers would get it because, you know, when situations are horrible when you're in the military, you sometimes laugh because so you don't cry and or go crazy. And Joe, that was part of his intent for that song. He still gets hate mail to this day. People say, you know, disrespectful, unpatriotic, anti-American, and yet Joe intended that in a different way, and I think that's why that song came up again and again and again as we interviewed these men and women who got what Joe was intending, and sang that song in Vietnam in order to keep themselves from crying.
You know, in the early days of the war, one favorite song was the very patriotic-sounding Sergeant Barry Sadler's Ballad of the Green Berets. Remember this one?
Train to live off nature's land, trained in combat hand to hand, men who fight by night and day, courage take from the Green Beret.
You know, I think it's fair to conclude that when you write about this in the book, Doug, that tastes in popular music changed and changed dramatically over the course of the war, because as you write, as the war changed, the music changed with it. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's just listening to the song, Steve, when you think of all the incredible music in 1966 in America, the Beatles, you know, just getting to their heights. This is prior to Sgt. Pepper. The Stones were great. A lot of the British groups, Motown, country. That was the number one song of the year, Ballad of the Green Berets. Which, wow. It really astounding. But, you know, by the time that year ended, I mean, as you pointed out, the Beach Boys went from fun, fun, fun to Good Vibrations. You know, look at what happened to the Beatles. James Brown went from I Feel Good to Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. There was like seismic shifts going on in America that was amplified in the music. And the soldiers got that. You know, I was in college when I was hearing these songs and getting, you know, getting my attitude. And then here I am a soldier and the song stayed with me. But boy, they could change some meaning. And then the music changed, as you said, drastically, dramatically.
You know, one song you wanted to talk about was Chuck Berry and Johnny B. Goode. Is there a Missouri connection with that one?
Well, of course, you know, Chuck is
from St. Louis.
He's from St. Louis. And that, of course, you know, when you had these cover bands, and we had absolutely really, really great cover bands in Vietnam. I want to give a major shout out. And we interviewed a guy in the book, a guy named Edgar Acosta, who is a Filipino who sang in a group called the Six Uglies, had one of the members of his band killed in Vietnam, you know, when they were subjected to a rocket attack. But the Filipino bands, the Korean bands, the Vietnamese bands were wonderful, and they entertained us. Every time they would have an absolutely tremendous guitar player who would play Johnny B. Goode. And if that didn't take us back to our, you know, to our youth, to the spawning of rock and roll, to the beginning of us identifying ourselves as a different generation, as the rock and roll generation, there's not many songs that do it better than Johnny B. Goode.
Hey, I just got about 20 seconds left. I want to get to one other track, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. You write in the book that Marvin Gaye wrote it after listening to his brother's experiences in Vietnam. Just tell us quickly about Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye listened to Frankie. He did what a lot of people didn't do. He said, if you want to talk, I'm willing to listen. It helped to get his brother home. And he made one of the all-time great songs and great albums, What's Going On, as a tribute and also as sort of an indication of what his brother Frankie and other Vietnam vets were experiencing.
Doug Bradley.
It healed him.
Doug Bradley's book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Hey, it's been great having you, Doug. Thanks for a great conversation.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we visited the new block galleries at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, writer and literary activist Francine Prose tells us about America's need for the written word. Be sure to join us for that conversation. Here's my conversation with the prolific writer of all things guitar, Alan DePerna. Let no less an authority than Carlos Santana, whose music we're hearing right now, describe the impact of the instrument known as the electric guitar. He writes this: to be able to touch someone and change their molecular structure with just one note is very powerful. One note can bring someone back from the edge, make lovers come together, create life and wars, and make you shed tears of joy and sorrow all at the same time. It is called, he says, the universal tone. This morning, a conversation about the history and impact of that beast called the electric guitar. With us is Alan DePerna. He's co-author of a fascinating new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. He's also a longtime contributor to Guitar World and Guitar Aficionado. Alan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Why does this sound resonate with us to the extent that it does?
Well, it's kind of embedded in our culture by this point. You know, the electric guitar has been around for a good 80 years or so, and it's really found a place for itself, or a place has been found for it, and in virtually every vernacular music genre that we have, certainly rock and roll music in all its permutations, but also soul, funk, reggae, country, blues, you name it.
It can do so much, you're saying, right? It can do so much.
Yeah, it's a very versatile instrument by nature of its design. You know, you're converting physical string vibrations into an electrical signal that, you know, once it's in that domain, anything can be done to it tonally, and a lot has been done to it over the years.
You know, in your book, you take us to Hollywood to give us the man who made a major contribution here. He was a refugee from Texas, and his name was George Delmencia Beauchamp, if I'm saying that right. Who was he?
Oh, actually, it's pronounced Beecham, which is weird.
Beecham.
Because
okay.
Because it's spelled like the French Beauchamp, so you think. But no, it was a family from Texas. He was a guitar player who, just like guitar players today, make their way from, you know, more rural parts of the country and the world to big major entertainment centers, which in the 1920s, the period we're talking about, was Hollywood. He came to town, found work as a vaudeville guitar player, did Hawaiian music, which was a hugely popular genre at that time. But he made his mark there, and he found himself confronted with the same problem that a lot of guitarists were finding themselves confronted with, is that in a larger band setting or orchestral setting, the instrument just wasn't loud enough. When you're competing with a piano, with a horn section, you know, basically the guitar doesn't cut it. It had recently taken over from the banjo as kind of the plucked string rhythm instrument of choice. And, you know, the banjo has a bit louder acoustic tone. So Beecham was one of several people trying to figure out how to amplify the guitar thing. So
he wanted it to be louder then?
Essentially louder, yeah. And then once you get to louder, there's a whole range of tonal possibilities that are suddenly there that hadn't been there before.
But, how did he do it?
Well, as I said, converting the physical vibration of a string into a disruption of a magnetic field into an electrical signal via something called a pickup. Beecham was the guy who figured out that what you needed to be focusing on with the pickup is the string itself. Traditional guitar design said that the top of the guitar, you know, the part that has the big round hole in it or the F-holes in it, is the source of vibration. So people were trying to attach electrical pickups to that, to, you know, different parts of the instrument. But, you know, Beecham's simple but brilliant revelation really is that the string is the thing. It's the most immediate source of vibration. So he started working with a phonograph pickup, actually. So he started fooling with that and eventually perfected a design. And by 1932 had, you know, what's regarded as the first commercially produced electric guitar on the market, the Ropatin A25, known as the frying pan, because it had a small round body and a big long neck, so it kind of looked like a frying pan.
You know, one thing I really liked about this book is you get a sense reading it that, you know, it's one contribution leading to another, both in the invention of the electric guitar and then the music that was played on it as well. I mean, the sound we hear from a group like Led Zeppelin never would have happened if folks like Joe Walsh hadn't come along, that one contributed to the next.
Oh, yeah, it's a real kind of chain. And yeah, there's all these kind of fortuitous things. You know, the sound of hard rock is, you know, the result of a couple of different things. Jimmy Page was primarily playing a Gibson Les Paul, a guitar that had been introduced in 1952 and initially wasn't very successful. By 1961, it had gone out of production. But some of the rock players, rock and blues players, like Mike Bloomfield, Eric Clapton, picked it up once again and put it together with a new type of amplifier that had come along in England, the Marshall amp, which had been very much developed at the behest of Pete Townsend of The Who, who went into Jim Marshall, the music store owner in London, and Well, basically, he brought his old Fender amp in, plunked it down on the counter, and said, "I want this twice as loud." Wow. So again, it was sort of a quest for volume, but had these little, you know, had Jimmy Page not plug that Gibson Les Paul into that particular Marshall amp. Yeah, the whole, you know, we would be listening to a very different style of rock music today.
You know, Alan, you mentioned Les Paul. What did he bring us? Because I think it has to do with the importance of a log, like a wooden log. Tell us about that.
Les was one of several people who were experimenting with solid body guitar designs. You have to remember that, you know, the guitar, as it comes down to us from history, is a hollow body instrument. It's a big hollow box, basically, with a neck and strings attached to it. And the purpose of that hollow box is to amplify the sound acoustically. Hmm. Well, once you've got electrical amplification, once you've got pickups and an amp, you don't need the big old box anymore. And in fact, the big old box is going to cause problems, such as feedback and unwanted sort of, you know, tonal howling sounds and everything. Which in later years, you know, people like Jimi Hendrix would discover uses for these seemingly unwanted sounds. But at that time, it was not something you wanted. So, yeah, Les was one of the people who said, well, if we go to just a solid plank of wood, then we are isolating that all important string vibration from the physical vibration of the instrument. A lot of people think Les originated that idea. He did not. 1935, there was already a solid body guitar on the market called the Slingerland Songster, which is not too well known, but it's clearly a predecessor of Les Paul's log, which dates from about 1941. So, you know, Les was one of those players who also was looking at the physical and the technical characteristics of the instrument, looking at how they could be modified. And he was also a great entertainer, a great storyteller. So he was one of those figures who was on the radio very early playing the electric guitar. And, of course, when television came along, he was one of the first people on television with an electric guitar. So, in addition to his technical contributions and his great musical contributions, fantastic player. He's a bit of a huckster, quite honestly, but he was a great ambassador for the electric guitar.
Alan DePerna is my guest. He's co-author of a new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. How about Muddy Waters' contribution?
Oh, Muddy Waters' contribution was also really immense. I mean, here was another player from Mississippi who started out as an acoustic blues player, playing, you know, the traditional Delta style, made his way to Chicago, Muddy put together the first all-electric band, basically. He switched from his acoustic guitar to a Fender Telecaster. It was one of the earlier players to embrace the Telecaster. And, basically the whole Chicago blues style originates with, you know, the work of people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. This style, of course, gets picked up by people like the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton in England, who seek to emulate, you know, the sounds that they're hearing from these Chess records, which were records that were mainly made for the African-American community at the time. They were not mass culture hits in the way that, you know, the music of the Stones and Clapton would become, but all roads in contemporary rock, you could say, kind of lead us back to Muddy Waters.
How about Chuck Berry? And I want to play a little bit of Johnny B. Goode in the background here. What did he do?
Well, Chuck. There it is.
There he is.
Yeah. Chuck was one of the guys. Coincidentally enough, one of the things Chuck did when he came to Chicago is he went to see his hero, Muddy Waters, and he said, well, you know, I'm a guitar player, I write songs, I sing, and I want to make a career in music, what should I do? Muddy tells him, well, you have to go see Chess Records, the Chess Brothers, over in Chicago, which was the label that was putting out these, you know, these great Muddy Waters records, Howlin' Wolf. So, you know, Chuck goes to them. He had one foot in the African American blues, you know, blues and R&B tradition, but there was also a kind of country influence. A song called Ida Red became one of his big hits, Maybelline, Twisted Around, and I remember Ike Turner said that, from Ike and Tina Turner said that, that when he first heard it, somebody told him this is a black guy, he couldn't believe it. He thought it was like some white guy from the country. So Chuck, and amazing synthesis of these kind of two main styles that go to make up rock and roll music, blues and country, had a baby basically, and they called it rock and roll. To this, he adds a phenomenal gift and capability as a lyricist, as an ability to tell stories in song. And one of the great stories he tells is of Johnny B. Goode, who's kind of the archetypal quintessential guitar hero. This, poor boy from the wrong side of the tracks. He doesn't have much money. He carries his guitar around in a burlap sack. But man, he can play the guitar, and as a result, it's this kind of rags to riches, Horatio Alger kind of thing. But cast in musical terms, cast in terms of you could say African American empowerment.
Right.
Chuck Berry is another one of those guys, hugely important.
You go on to Eric Clapton, Eddie Van Halen, and you get the sense that these guys, they were like tinkerers, almost the same way that some guys mess around with hot rods, Alan.
Definitely, yeah. And there's a real kind of parallel. I mean, Van Halen's coming up in Southern California, in the mid to late 70s, Eddie Van Halen was the guy who was, he was not satisfied with the quality of American-made guitars at the time. Both Fender and Gibson had taken a bit of a downward turn. Van Halen just started to fool around, swapping out different pickups, different parts of the guitars. He wanted some qualities of the Fender. He would combine with other qualities of the Gibson design. So he put together what's called, the Frankenstrat, or the Frankenstein Stratocaster.
You guys write that the British invasion was to guitar music roughly what the Gutenberg Bible and advent of printing had been to literacy. So let's talk about that. What did the Beatles add to the equation?
Well, prior to them, in rock music and in popular music generally, the focus was on a singer, Elvis Presley, Bing Crosby, whoever it may be. Instrumentalists were in the background. They were accompanists. The Beatles were one of the first self-contained electric guitar-playing groups. They wrote their own songs, which was also really, really revolutionary. At the time, it was much more common for a professional songwriter to create a song that an A&R person then put together with the correct artist who, sang the song. The Beatles blew all that out the window. They very quickly convinced their producer, George Martin, that, hey, our song is just as good as the one that you've lined up for us. Perhaps it's even better. So here's this group of four young men playing their own instruments, writing their own songs. Many, many, many kids all across the world started saying, hey, we can do this. You can get a guitar in the Sears catalog for whatever it was back then, 80 bucks or something. And, let's get together in the garage and, try to play some of these songs. You didn't have to go to Juilliard, to be able to play Johnny B. Goode or Louie Louie or one of those kinds of songs.
Were they the first group to use guitar feedback in recorded music?
Absolutely, yeah.
They were?
Yeah. It is I Feel Fine. Yeah, that.
Here we go. We're going to listen to it right now.
Baby's good to me. You know she's happy as can be. You know she said so. I'm in love with her.
Well, I want to move on to page 189 in the book, because you write this on this page. If a poll were taken to determine the single most influential electric guitar performance in the instrument's entire history, the majority of votes would most likely go to this tour de force musical moment. And I'm talking about Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock and his playing of the Star Spangled Banner. Let's listen just a little bit of that. Why is this moment so highly regarded, Alan?
Well, it was It was the height of the Vietnam era.
Right.
Resistance to the Vietnam War was really at a fever pitch. It was the Woodstock Festival, which was kind of the culmination of this whole hippie scene, which had come together. 66, 67, building momentum. It had really become a huge thing. Hendrix at the time was probably the biggest, most significant rock performer at the time. He gets on stage, he does his set. It's early in the morning, actually, because Woodstock, as most people know, is so horribly disorganized.
And this song wasn't rehearsed, was it?
No. Hendrix may have started to fool around with it a bit, but I talked to Billy Cox, the bass player, and
because you can hear Billy Cox starting to play along with him, but then he stops, recognizing
couple of
smartly
notes,
that this song is something extraordinary here.
Right. Yeah. So Hendrix goes into this thing and basically without saying a word, makes it a protest song. He makes a statement about what was going on in the world, in America at the time, in incorporating the sounds of bombs blasting, of the ambulance siren. He basically plunges us into the hellish chaos of war, juxtaposed with the American national anthem, this kind of glorious battle hymn of victory.
And not surprisingly, a lot of Americans were hugely upset at what he had done here.
Yes, there was outcry that he had, shown disrespect for the country or its national anthem. And at the time, for an African American to speak out on political issues was not something that happened frequently. Performers still had to be careful. Muhammad Ali was outspoken. The Black Panthers were on the scene, but. To make that kind of political statement was bold. And Hendrix kind of, the quote is in the book. I forgot his exact words, but he just said, hey, I'm an American. He says, well, it's kind of like go America, go. But, we play it the way things are in America right now. And right now in America, the air is a little staticky. There was outcry. But on the other hand, those who were opposed to the war, particularly young people of the counterculture, they knew what was going on. I mean, they didn't need to read the paper the next morning to have that explained to them.
Alan DePerna's new book, Play It Loud, An Epic History of the Style, Sound, and Revolution of the Electric Guitar. And Alan, I wish we had more time. This is just a fascinating book. Really appreciate you taking some time with us.
Oh, hey, Steve. Great to be here, and I'm always happy to talk about the electric guitar.
Oh, it's a great topic. Thanks again, Alan.
You're welcome.
State House Blend Missouri is hosted by KCUR's Brian Ellison and takes a look at what's going on in and around the state's legislature.
Joining us this week in the KCUR production studio is Representative Greg Razor, a Democrat from Kansas City, joining us for the first time. Greg, nice to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really glad you could join us. And also here is KCUR's news director and my boss, Maria Carter.
Hi, Brian.
Good to see you, Maria. Well, there are definitely some things you have spoken up about, and we're going to ask you about those today. Let me start by going to my colleague, Maria Carter.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was recently reading about was a letter you sent to Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, chief of staff, wanting to know about who was paying for his flights. He's chosen not to use the state plane for many of his trips. I think he's used it once. Why'd you send that letter?
So this is not what I want to be working on in Jefferson City. Let me start by saying that. I don't want to be in a battle with the governor's office. So I sent a letter, an official request for any flights that the governor had used in his official capacity as governor of the state of Missouri. What plane he was on and who paid for that trip. There is a law that requires the governor to provide that. If on a state-owned plane, there's this little weird loophole that was embedded into the law. And I pointed that out in my letter, that I would hope they wouldn't use that loophole to shield who they have paying for these trips. And in fact, that's exactly what they did. If there's nothing to hide, then just tell us who's paying to fly you there. And why aren't you using the plane the taxpayers provide for you?
What else is on your mind, Maria?
Well, I think, you know, what's in the news today in Kansas City is a minimum wage bill in the legislature that's been proposed that would limit the ability of cities to enact a higher minimum wage. And, you know, we won't go into the whole history of all that, but, you know, what are your thoughts on that and, you know, kind of the state taking a stand as, you know, cities are looking to perhaps do their own thing that they deem is best for their residents?
You know, I think this is an issue that if a city, if whether it's St. Louis, Kansas City, Columbia, whoever wants to pass an ordinance raising the minimum wage, if they want to, I know the city of Columbia had said you had to be 21 to buy cigarettes or ban plastic bags, they should be allowed to do it. There is this fascinating theory amongst the kind of the far right, and I've seen it so often in my short time in Jefferson City, that they call it federalism, that the state governments are in charge of everything, that the federal government is subservient to the states because we created the federal government, and the local governments have to listen to the states because we created them. Therefore, everything derives from Jefferson City. I would disagree with that. I think we have court decisions proving the opposite, and we fought a war about it in the 1860s that kind of settled that issue. But it goes back to that theory. And, you know, I think you go back. We're talking about people. Let's say it's somebody that's working 40 hours a week. And if you're working 40 hours a week, you should be paid enough that you can get by without government assistance.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working 40 hours a week, you shouldn't need Medicaid. You shouldn't need food stamps as well. That's the government subsidizing these private companies if that's the way we do it. And for many large companies that are big employers in rural Missouri, that is the way we do it. Their employees are on government assistance. And to move that even farther, something I didn't realize, 14% of all full-time MoDOT employees are eligible for public assistance,
wow,
Medicaid or food stamps. Our own state employees.
Yes. Well, I mean, and on that note, there's another piece of legislation that's moved forward this week over on the Senate side that would change employment discrimination law. Mm-hmm. So now if this bill becomes law, it's on its way over to you in the House, to win a case, an employee to show bias would have to show that bias was a motivating factor and not just a contributing factor, meaning it's going to be harder to sue for wrongful termination, that you'd have to show that bias is the reason someone was fired as opposed to just a factor in it, basically. Are you going to be supporting this when it comes over to the House?
No, and I'm not an attorney, but from what I understand, it doesn't just make it harder. It makes it nearly impossible to prove that, you know, discrimination was the motivating factor of firing. I think an employer could say, well, there was that day you were 5 minutes late, and that's why you were fired. And can you prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that that wasn't the reason? Mm-hmm. It makes it nearly impossible, and it really hurts our non-discrimination laws in the state of Missouri.
One of the longer debate over this bill was on an amendment to the bill that would have added sexual orientation as one of the protected mm-hmm. classes. That amendment was defeated. Not passing, apparently, this year as the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. You're the co-sponsor, along with Randy Dunn,
yes,
of this bill in the House. This is the 19th year in a row the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act has been introduced in both the House and the Senate. Probably won't pass, it would seem. I guess I want to ask you about the state of LGBTQ issues and legislation in Missouri. You're now one of a handful of openly gay legislators. What's the horizon look like? What's the situation from your perspective?
The fascinating part is many years ago I advocated in Jefferson City on behalf of this very bill that I now have the honor of introducing. And back then, I think we had one or two Republicans that co-sponsored, but we really focused on trying to get Democratic co-sponsors. And, you know, they were near the majority at that time. And what I would hear, the inner city Democrats jumped right on board to co-sponsor. rural Democrats ran from it, and Democrats in suburban communities would give me the example of, Greg, if it ever comes to the floor, we'll vote with you, but we can't put ourselves out on that limb as far as to co-sponsor it. As I go and talk to a lot of my Republican colleagues now, some 15 years later, there are no inner city Republicans, but from what I'm hearing is a lot of suburban Republicans saying quietly, Greg, if this comes to the floor, we're probably with you, but we can't put ourselves out on the limb. It's interesting to see this mirror effect of where my Republican colleagues are now, who are good-hearted and not bigoted on this issue at all, but where they are politically on this issue to where Democrats were nearly 15 years ago.
Have you ever encountered in the legislature discrimination or any different kind of treatment because you are gay?
I haven't. I had a Republican approach me in the parking garage. This was maybe 2 weeks ago, and said, "Hey, Greg, I just wanted to let you know I had no idea you were gay. Just want you to know that mattered to me. You know, we don't ever vote the same, but I like you. You're a good guy. I just want you to know that I know, and I'm cool with it." I think it would be weird if it was another inner city liberal, but knowing where the person was coming from, I think that was a big step forward.
Yeah. Do you think, just almost wondering if it's almost like one of those things, that person might have been worried that you'd make assumptions if he was a rural Republican or, you know, et cetera, that, you know, he wasn't okay with it.
And I'm probably a little ashamed to say that I do make that assumption. I think we all have built-in assumptions that we make, and there are probably members that I shouldn't make that assumption about.
Yeah.
And I think all of us are guilty of that to some degree.
It's tough being human.
Yes, yes.
And speaking of being human, I do want to disclose for our listeners, my work at KCUR is part-time. The other part of my time, I'm executive director of a nonprofit that does advocacy work on LGBT issues, mostly in a religious context, but we try to be objective about this and on everything else, but I wanted you, our listeners, to know that in full disclosure. Maria Carter, anything else from you today?
No, I'm all questioned out.
All right. Greg Razor, there is one last question we have for you. It's only for the broadcast version of the program,
okay.
Which is, what song do you think really captures this moment in the life of Missouri? That's the song we're going to end on.
Boy, this is depressing. What came to my mind as soon as you ask it is Elvis has a song called Way Down. That's kind of what I thought of.
That's how you feel like Missouri's doing right now.
Yeah, but the pendulum's going to swing back.
All right.
Going to be fine.
Way Down by Elvis. State Representative Greg Razor, Democrat of Kansas City, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, Maria Carter.
Thanks, Brian.
Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp and Brian Ellison. We'll see you around.
Sign up for full episodes of Statehouse Blend Missouri and Kansas wherever you get your podcasts. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, writer and literary activist Francine Prose. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.